Welcome to the Flourishing After Addiction podcast. I'm Carl Eric Fisher, an addiction psychiatrist and bioethicist. This podcast, my website, and my newsletter are all devoted to understanding addiction and flourishing and making sure those explorations are accessible for everyone. In this podcast, I interview leading experts, teachers, and people with lived experience, ranging across a diversity of fields from science to spirituality and everything in between. The whole idea is to find points of contact and synthesis, and I'm hoping that this will be a home for broad, deep, and curious conversations about addiction and recovery. If you want to learn more, please head over to my website. You can sign up for my newsletter to stay up to date with the latest episodes, show notes, and other writings. You can find that at carlericfisher.com. In this episode, I was thrilled to be talking with Maya Svalovitz. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller, Unbroken Brain, A Revolutionary New Way of Understanding Addiction, which received the 2018 Media Award from the National Institute on Drug Abuse. It's a wonderful blend of her narrative as a person in addiction recovery herself, along with science and policy journalism. Maya is a really accomplished journalist and writer. She's written earlier books like Help at Any Cost about the troubled teen industry. It exposed the damage caused by tough love, businesses and youth treatment, and also co-authored and authored six other books. She has an enormous body of work, a breadth of knowledge that really positions her as someone great at synthesizing and getting the bird's eye view of what's most important in addiction and recovery. And most recently, she's turned to the history of harm reduction. Her latest book, Undoing Drugs, The Untold Story of Harm Reduction and the Future of Addiction, was published in July 2021. We cover a lot of ground on this crucial topic. Where our drug laws come from in the first place, how you can't criminalize and destigmatize something at the same time, and then how to make sense of harm reduction as a paradigm and as a social movement. We talk about some of the pioneers in integrating harm reduction in the 12 steps and talk about problems with 12 steps in medicine, as well as the good stuff in 12-step recovery. You know, Maya is a really committed person who has written about her significant many years history in 12-step recovery and seems to support 12 steps as a good step and a good pathway to recovery, but really boldly articulates the problems with the over-medicalization of the 12 steps in certain contexts. So you can really hear the emotion in her voice and how much it matters to her in this episode. And that's a passion that has driven her to make some really great work. So I left it stimulated and energized. I hope you do too. Please enjoy my conversation with Maya Svalovitz. So Maya, thanks so much for joining me and for coming on to talk about your great new book.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
And I know a lot of your prior work, you've been writing on drugs and addiction and policy for a while. And I'd imagine a lot of our listeners are familiar with your work too. Could you tell us a little bit about what was it about your personal history that inspired you or connected with writing this history of harm reduction?
Sure. So basically harm reduction saved my life. I was injecting drugs in New York City in 1986 when about half of IV drug users were already HIV positive. And I didn't even know that AIDS could affect IV drug users at that point because most of the media coverage was really focused on gay men. So I wasn't a gay man. So I just thought, okay, that's a horrible thing and we should fight it, but it didn't seem to affect me personally. And then, of course, I found out that, yes, you better start cleaning your needles, otherwise you are going to be in serious trouble. And when I realized that AIDS was affecting drug users, I was, first of all, I was angry because nobody was even bothering to tell us that we were at risk. And then telling us how to protect ourselves would encourage people to use drugs. So we were supposed to just lie down and die as an example to other people. And I just thought, that is just wrong.
It's so vital that you came back to that time period to write the history. So tell us more about the history. You call it the first history of harm reduction. Why did you feel the history was necessary? Tell us more about just the overall project.
Well, basically, harm reduction is a movement to within drug policy to focus on harm rather than highs, and to put people's lives and health at the center of policy, not some abstract goal of X number of drugs should be eliminated. So I saw this movement growing, and there were several other people from time to time was like, oh yeah, I'm going to write a history of it, and then they didn't. So I was like, okay, well, I guess nobody else is going to do it, so I better do it because people are not going to be here forever, and we've already lost some really great people in the field. and people's memories are not always so great. You know, I mean, a lot of the work of the book was just trying to get people to remember what happened when, because, you know, when you're an activist and you're just out there doing your thing, like, you are not, you know, you're not writing things down necessarily. You aren't necessarily keeping track of the sequence of things. And especially since, like, a lot of important stuff happens at conferences, which aren't very memorable, except for, like, things that are not relevant to the conference, which may be fascinating gossip. So, you know, so it was just very important to do it as quickly as possible and to, you know, talk to as many people as possible.
So what was it like reporting it? I mean, you've been a reporter and you've done some great reporting that I can imagine doing essentially an oral history that spans multiple countries and multiple time periods. That must have been a totally different experience. What was the writing process like for you?
Well, it was really overwhelming. This was the hardest book of mine to structure, and figuring out, you know, how to tell the story of specific ideas within the movement and how to show how the movement spread and why it mattered. It was very daunting. And it was a massive organizational issue because I just had so much material and I had to make sure I got as much as possible so I didn't leave something critical out. And of course, I had to leave lots of critical things out just because I didn't want to write a 10,000 page book. So it was very nerve-wracking also because I care about people in the harm reduction movement and I didn't want to, like, tell people their contribution was not important, which I don't mean. But people would think, oh, well, I'm in the footnotes or I'm not mentioned. So they're, you know, and so that, you know, that just personally and emotionally was difficult. But I figured that, you know, I'm a journalist, I'm an author, my loyalty has to be to the reader so that people can get an idea of what this is, why it matters, and then they can go learn more and write more about the, you know, the history that still remains to be told.
Yeah, you say in your author's note that this is your history, it's the first history, and there are many more histories to be told. Could you say more about that, and maybe even more about, like, what you see is still out there?
Sure. Well, I had to focus on, you know, mainly sort of the East Coast and the West Coast, and Vancouver, Liverpool, a little bit of Amsterdam and Rotterdam, Chicago, but there's a massive world of harm reduction beyond that, like the entire world, for one. I felt really horrible. The Australians made some really great contributions to harm reduction, but I just couldn't figure out a way to make that work in there. So somebody needs to do a history of Australian and also just broader European, African, Latin American harm reduction. So that's like the rest of the world, right? But then there's also within the United States, I have a little bit of Southern harm reduction with the chapter on Louise Vincent, but there's Atlanta, there's just so much. And somebody is thinking about doing a history of harm reduction in the Black community, which is a very, very, very critical book that is much needed. And I tried to put as much as I could in here, but, you know, again, it was like I had to tell sort of the broadest story, trying to be as representative as possible, but also just use the people and the ideas to make sure that why this mattered was clear to the reader.
There's so much there. I mean, obviously such a huge, huge project, and really admire you for doing it. But before we go deeper into some of the history that you just mentioned, I was wondering if we could circle back to the notion of harm reduction. And I consider myself harm reduction clinician insofar as my goal is to meet the patient where they are and to not put any sort of value or belief system on them. But I also know that there's discussion within the harm reduction community and theorists and otherwise that there are different ideas about what constitutes harm reduction. And even from the beginning, as you chronicle, it's deeply tied up with notions of sociology and policy and even philosophy. So I was wondering if you could say a little more about, like, just like how would you define harm reduction, and is there a way of making sense of those different dimensions, say, like, from the individual to the social?
Sure. So I define harm reduction as the movement within drug policy to focus on stopping people from getting hurt rather than stopping people from getting high. And so this automatically moves the focus to how do we preserve life and health rather than how do we stop people from taking drugs? And that automatically comes to involve social justice because our drug laws are racist. And they were not passed in any scientific way. They were just sort of a series of moral panics, which is even how we ended up with alcohol prohibition. And it's always about some group that white people, mainly white men, are worried about. And they're especially worried about that group taking their women. So it's sexist too. But so all of that gets wrapped into this little phrase. And it has all these implications, which I was trying to show, because basically once you take the focus off the drugs and put the focus on the harm, you have to look at the harm that's done by policy itself. And that is just shattering to prohibition. It is shattering to most of our current practices in the addictions field. So it is a very radical idea. And because of that, people tried to suppress it really early on, because it's also common sense. Like anybody who has not been indoctrinated in the drug war says, yeah, we should give them clean needles. We don't want people to die. You know, yeah, like we should make sure people are as healthy as possible because dead people don't recover. It's not rocket science in that sense, but it's also deeply empathetic and must center the person who is doing the behavior that everybody else wants to change because it's harmful, because imposing that from the outside is what got us into all this trouble in the first place. So we need to understand why people take drugs and what drugs do for people and how can we minimize the harm in this behavior that is so ancient and so deeply rooted in at least mammalian history. It's not just human. You know, you go back and you see, like, you know, cats and catnip, drunken monkeys, you know, animals actually, the non-human animals actually enjoy getting high too. So to think that this is something that you can stop or stomp out and that it is a behavior that is just immoral and we must stop it. Well, what tends to happen is we choose a few intoxicants that we like, and then we don't call them drugs and we call everything else drugs and then we try to stomp it out. And those choices are made for arbitrary cultural reasons, not to do with the harms actually related to the substances. And often those arbitrary cultural reasons are racism. So it is just tied up in all of these different things. And that does make it hard to define. And you do get issues where maybe there is a conflict between reducing harm for an individual and reducing harm for society. But for the most part, we haven't even reduced harm at all. So we don't even get into that complex territory. And what has been fascinating to see as harm reduction has been studied is that all of this stuff, like if you give people heroin, they'll never quit. You're enabling them. You are just extending their addiction and it's going to be a disaster. Well, actually, they get better. And they are, people who are taking prescription heroin are no less likely to become abstinent than people who are taking heroin on the street. In fact, they're more likely. So all of this nonsense about enabling and forcing people to hit bottom and the first drink gets you drunk and all of these things that we've been taught in American culture are absolute truths about addiction are actually not. Now, that's not to say some of those things may not be true for some people. But it's really, we've had this huge problem where in the field, people have been encouraged to generalize from their own anecdotes. So it's like, this worked for me, so it should work for you. And if not, you're doing it wrong. Instead of, oh, maybe you need something different because you're a different person than me. Instead of like thinking like a scientist or a doctor, we have had this idea in part because the medical profession abandoned addiction, in part because they were forced to by the legal system. But we end up with this complex tangle of things that is really difficult to deal with. And harm reduction is kind of like an Occam's razor. It cuts right into the center of it and says, this is what we must do. Let's not get distracted by the pretty drugs in the corner. Let us just try to make people healthier, happier, and keep them alive. Because all, you know, because people because human life matters. We should not be saying because you take a particular substance, you deserve to die.
Yeah. And thinking like a scientist or a doctor, I think is a good ideal to hold in mind. But as you're right, the stigma and just general social perceptions creep into medicine and they creep into science as well. And in many ways can influence our treatment industry. So, you know, I think that's a very clear description of the broad level social policy. And I'm wondering if you could say a little more about how the war on drugs and our drug policy influences the treatment system specifically.
Well, we basically see addiction as a sin and a crime. And our treatment system is incredibly punitive as a result. There is nowhere else in medicine where you can go to a treatment center and be told that your treatment is meeting confession and prayer and not be in some kind of alternative medicine setting. You know, if I go to doctor for depression and he says, well, you know, you need to like take a moral inventory and you need to make amends and you need to, I'd be like, you know, what? Like, that is not the way we treat things we consider diseases. Nor do we lock up people for eating a donut when they have diabetes in the idea that that will somehow fix the problem. So our system is flawed in large part because of both these moralistic ideas about addiction and because of the criminalization of certain drugs. So you can't criminalize something and destigmatize it at the same time, which is what we seem to be attempting to do. The whole point of criminalizing something is to stigmatize it, because if criminalizing doesn't stigmatize something, then people aren't going to not do the behavior, and then you're going to have lots of disrespect for the law. And if you criminalize people who feel that they don't have any other choice but to do this behavior, you're just locking them up over and over again. And, you know, the thing, after years and years of thinking about addiction, the best definition that I have found, and this National Institute on Drug Abuse agrees with, and the DSM, compulsive drug use that continues in the face of negative consequences. What does that mean? Punishment is exactly what won't work, because the behavior continues despite negative consequences. But our entire system is devoted to shaming and humiliating people, forcing them to say how bad they are, forcing them to, you know, take moral inventory and make amends, which I have nothing against if that's for everybody. But I have a problem with when that's the only thing in medicine that that is the treatment for. And I think that for many people with addiction, 12-step groups can be helpful, but they should not be treatment for addiction. They are not treatment for addiction. Paying for 12-step teachings as addiction is one of the big, as addiction treatment is one of the biggest mistakes we've made as a country in terms of dealing with addiction. Because for one, we're paying for what we can get for free. Secondly, it is not useful for everybody. And thirdly, it is deeply moralistic. Like, people have often said, oh, the, you know, issue with 12 steps is the God stuff and the spirituality stuff. That isn't necessarily the problem. To me, the core of the problem is that it says you're a bad person. It pretends to be saying that it's a disease, but it's basically, you don't take a moral inventory when you have cancer. So it is really, you know, it's deeply problematic to have a medical system that is actually teaching people this ideology. It's perfectly fine to refer people to group support that can be really helpful socially. And even some people actually feel better about themselves when they take moral inventory and go through the process of the steps. And I'm not saying that that isn't a valid process for some people, but it is not medical treatment. It is not psychological or psychiatric treatment. And we need to separate those things in order to make the treatment system better. The other fundamental problem is when you have an opioid epidemic and your 12-step program, the primary 12-step program that focuses on opioid addiction, Narcotics Anonymous, says that if you are taking the only two medications we have that cut the death rate by 50% or more, if you're taking them, you're not clean. That's a massive problem. So you have a treatment system that's indoctrinating people against the only medications we have that actually preserve life. So we're simultaneously, you know, doing these contradictory things. And so this is, again, there are certain NA groups that have gone beyond that and do allow people to see themselves as in recovery if they continue to take methadone or buprenorphine. But the book that is the big book of NA does not say that's okay. And their literature does not say that's okay. In many meetings, you're not even allowed to talk. So yeah, so that needs to get out of the treatment system, and we need to put the kind of medical care that is not moralistic that we have for depression and anxiety disorders and psychosis. We need to put that into the treatment system and make it professionalized. Now, that said, there is absolutely a role for people who have personal experience of addiction in the treatment field. It's just that they need to be educated beyond their own experience. So if the only thing you know is how you got into recovery, I don't think you should be a counselor. If you know how you got into recovery and a lot about, you know, the sort of what is addiction and what does the research show and all of this kind of stuff, then yes, we absolutely want you, because your personal experience is valuable. It's just not the only thing that's valuable.
Right. Well, let me ask you about that. I think that's very clearly put, and you outline very well some of the problems with the contemporary treatment system and the way it becomes ideological. I'll say my personal view is that one of the chief problems is that AA was developed as a relatively narrow mutual help, non-medical intervention for people who are voluntarily seeking treatment.
Yes.
And then that was generalized to basically everyone.
And they were white Protestant men.
White Protestant men, you know, from a particular place and time. But then also in the process of adapting that into treatment, into the process of making this thing that was not medical into a medical thing, it became more ideological than, say, for example, the kind of sometimes like diverse and open-minded perspectives that people have in 12-step groups on the ground.
Well, that to me is like the tragedy of the thing, because when you go to meetings voluntarily, it is a completely different experience than you're forced to go there. And frankly, people who go to meetings voluntarily, it's not great to have other people who are just sitting there folding their arms and being like, when will this be over so you can sign my form? Like, that's not good for AA either. So to me, I always say to people who are, you know, asking about what they should do about an addiction, I think people should give 12-step groups a try, if only because you can get massive amounts of social support there and you can learn a lot about addiction. But the fundamental thing you have to keep in mind when you go to 12 steps is take what you like and leave the rest. If something doesn't ring true to you, that's fine. Do something different. If you like the process of the 12 steps, that's great. Go for it. But, you know, if you find yourself taking a moral inventory and you're supposed to talk about what was your personal role in being sexually abused, that may not be so good for you. Let's not do that, okay? Also, AA has this great pamphlet about how we are not doctors and how if you are honest with your doctor about your condition, you can take whatever medications you're prescribed as long as you take them as prescribed. And that includes opioids and stimulants and whatever else. So the idea that you should never take any other psychoactive substance in your life except for alcohol, no, except for tobacco and caffeine are okay. Everything else is not okay. It starts to fall apart under its own contradictions. But again, people and connection to people and support for each other are fundamental to recovery. And a lot of people get that from 12-step groups. And so I don't want to take away from that. And whatever, you know, so whenever I'm talking to somebody about like, well, you know, I have a problem, what should I do? I always suggest check this out, because you might find something there useful, but just don't take it as gospel.
Makes good sense. So there's a lot there we could talk about. We could probably have like a whole podcast series about 12 steps and the different varieties of 12 steps. But I want to get back to your book and your experience too, because as you talk about your own perspective on 12 step, I think about your history and I'm thinking back to Unbroken Brain, your last book. And if I remember right, you came in through a sort of criminal legal path to recovery. And I couldn't agree more that there's no place for punishment. There's no place for shame.
in the treatment of addiction. And we are so far over toward the side of punishment and over legalizing things. And they're even with drug courts that are presented as a compassionate alternative, sometimes there are real complications and problems with the way they're implemented sometimes. But I did want to ask if you think that there's a place for coercion or leverage in the treatment of addiction. But like, people might be wondering, what do you do with a person who is so impaired or has such severe problems that they have difficulty accessing treatment on their own, or they have some resistance, or otherwise like a family might be wondering, like, what can I do to help?
Coercion does not work. Coercion does harm. Now, if you're a family member and your addicted family member is stealing from you or doing other harm to the family, you might have to cut them off and you might have to cut contact with them and all of that kind of thing. But that is to protect yourself and your family, which is absolutely a good motive and there's nothing wrong with that. But to cut them off in hopes that that will fix them, it just doesn't work that way. We just have to get over the idea. Like, I actually voluntarily went into treatment. I was not coerced. I had legal pressures in the background. And probably if I didn't, I would have ended up in prison for a long time. But I chose to go to treatment when I went to treatment. And that is probably why I was able to embrace it the way I did, because I was voluntarily there and I chose to be there. And I thought, okay, everything else I've been trying isn't working. Let me try this. And, you know, I was involved with 12-step programs for many years, and I still think there is value in that experience. I just really have to speak against generalizing that to every single person with addiction. And that's what we do about coercion. You hear these people say, I would have never gotten in recovery if my family didn't do an intervention. And then you hear, well, you know, they did an intervention on Kurt Cobain and he shot himself. And we don't even have any research to show which outcome is more common. But we do have research showing that the gentler, supportive, harm reduction way of meeting people where they are and moving them towards recovery is much less harmful and much more effective than the confrontational, let's get in a meeting and scream at them approach. And
such an important point.
I want to make clear that, like, 12-step groups are not get in a meeting and scream at them, because that is not how 12-step groups are. There are just treatment programs that have this so-called therapeutic community model where it was based on this cult called Synanon. And the whole idea was to dismantle the person's personality by breaking them down and humiliating them. And that still infects a lot of our treatment system. I mean, that was in the 80s and 90s, probably at least half of all publicly funded treatment consisted of that kind of deliberate, humiliating, punitive treatment. And then we're like, why doesn't anybody seek treatment voluntarily? Well, would you? I mean, you know, it's like if the treatment is being in a group and being screamed at, being made to, you know, scrub the floor with a toothbrush, being made to wear a sign saying, I am a whore. Literally, I am not making any of those examples up. You know, why would anybody voluntarily sign up for that? So, and we know that that does harm. We know that that causes PTSD. We know that people actually get worse after that. Do some people get better? Yes, some people get better after horrific traumas in any kind of situation, and that's great for them. But it doesn't mean we say, okay, let's traumatize you in order to fix you, because some people grow after trauma.
It's an important, historical aside about the evolution. I think illustrates one of the influences on our treatment system and how it's not rationally created. And in many ways, because of the abdication of the medical profession's responsibility toward people with addiction, other groups stepped in often in harmful ways. But I want to get back. I think it was such an important point you made about your own personal history, because I think this can easily be lost in the sort of binary thinking around addiction treatment and how sometimes it intersects with the criminal legal system, that if I'm hearing you correctly, there were some legal issues going on with you, but ultimately your choice was your own. You went in voluntarily for treatment, and the fact that it was voluntary on your part and people supported your voluntariness actually improved your engagement. And that's my understanding of what the research supports, that even within systems that can be imperfect, like, we will be working within an imperfect system for a while now, you can do what you can do to lift up the individual and support their own self-efficacy. And to me, that sounds like a harm reduction principle. That sounds like
the other thing I should stress is I chose the treatment I went to. And to me, one of the biggest problems with coerced treatment is that if the system chooses the treatment, first of all, you have all those issues around the person's commitment. But you also have the case that the treatment provider gets an infinite amount of free patients that it doesn't have to do anything to attract. So you basically get a system, you know, like Alan Marlatt once said this to me, and it just stuck with me because he said, like, okay, let's say you're a car company and you build lousy cars. So what do? You get the government to mandate that people buy your cars. No, you have to build better cars in a capitalist system. And if we're going to be stuck in a capitalist system, we may as well make it work to our benefit so that treatment needs to attract people into it. Because if treatment needed to attract people into it, it would become much more user-friendly, as they say. And so when you have this source of, you know, half in some places, half or more of the people in a treatment center are put there by the legal system, that creates a bad environment for everybody who wants to be there. And it also creates a situation where the treatment program has no incentive to change anything because it's getting all the customers it needs.
Yeah, it makes good sense. So I want to ask about, I'm thinking about the listener. There might be someone out there who feels totally comfortable and confident in their own 12-step recovery or other form of traditional recovery. And maybe that works for them. And I wanted to ask if you had a message for them, why should someone who has, say, for example, come about through their own like individual process of recovery to a relatively stable place, why should they care about harm reduction today? What sorts of lessons do you have about the way the history of harm reduction affects us all?
First of all, if you are a committed 12-stepper, then you believe that you are one relapse away from being back to being an active drug user. That is inherent in the model. Like if you are really gung-ho in the 12 steps, you know that you have to care about active users because you might be one again. So if that's the case, which I believe it is, then you obviously want people who are using to stay alive. I mean, a lot of the earliest harm reductionists were people in 12-step recovery. And they were just outraged by the fact that we would go to meetings, people would be talking about, you know, having AIDS, and we weren't doing anything. Like we could see ACT UP out there on the streets doing things, but nobody was doing anything for us. And in fact, the institutions that were supposed to help us were like, oh no, we can't do needle exchange. That will encourage people to use. And it's like, okay, you want your patients to die. You know your patients relapse at a rate of 80 to 90%. So how is it okay that you're not doing anything to keep them alive during that? So anyway, those of us who were like that, this is partially also probably why I wasn't so welcomed in certain parts of 12-step, because I just felt like politically we had to do something. And I knew that meetings were not the place for the politics, but there needed to be a place for the politics because we were dying. And so anyway, so I felt no conflict whatsoever between being a person who's abstinent and being, you know, wanting needle exchange for people, because I knew I could relapse. My best friend could relapse. And if we want to, if our goal is to like 12-step people and get them into the program, if they're dead, that's not going to be very effective, is it?
Yeah, I think it's well said. Can you say more about the early folks, the early pioneers who were in 12-step recovery? Like who are some of these folks from your book? Can you tell us more about?
Sure. I mean, these people have been out about it, so I feel reasonably okay saying it. But Richard Elovich, who was one of the Needle 8 defendants, was active in 12-step recovery and was also a very important figure in bringing harm reduction into ACT UP and Damon's health crisis and bringing this whole idea that you can work with people who are still actively using. He had this whole thing, recovery readiness. So he's clearly one of them. Alan Clear, who was the head of the Harm Reduction Coalition for most of its history, came in originally as a 12-stepper and was very committed to that and ended up helping found the Lower East Side Needle Exchange and then becoming the executive director of the Harm Reduction Coalition, which actually helped spread the idea and coalesce the idea, you know, throughout the United States.
Those are great examples. I think there's such a need for synthesis. My view is that there's nothing incompatible with 12-step mutual help and harm reduction. And examples and stories like those of people who have done so, who have found those connections and those synthesis, I think are really beautiful because it suggests a way out of the sort of like polarized binaries we often find ourselves in.
I kind of consider myself one of those people because I, you know, in my early recovery, I literally went to 12-step meetings every day for at least 5 years and continued going less regularly for another 2 or 3. And then eventually sort of the contradictions got to me and I was getting annoyed at meetings rather than serene and relaxed. And I just felt that, okay, this doesn't make sense for me anymore. One of the things that sort of occasioned that was I finally got on antidepressants and that made such a huge difference in my personal experience of the world that I could socialize so much better because I wasn't this clingy, needy, anxious thing all the time. And I could be there for people and people could be there for me. And so I didn't have that kind of crazy social need that I had before I was able to, you know, manage my sensory and emotional overload via Prozac and Wellbutrin.
And so you mentioned ACT UP a few times. And I've wondered this several points in my own learning about the history of drug policy and harm reduction. Like ACT UP is such an amazing just episode in American public health and social justice. And it's not clear to me that we have like an ACT UP for addiction. In other words, like if somebody were in addiction recovery or had otherwise resolved a problem with substances and they looked around and they saw the weight of the contemporary overdose crisis, opioids, and now even more like meth, and they felt moved to act and they felt like their own sort of like health and flourishing depended on like finding some sort of response, some sort of engagement with that problem. It's not totally clear to me where someone like that would go. Can you help us with that? Any suggestions?
Sure. I first argued in 1993 in the Washington Post that we need an ACT UP for people with addiction. There are many problems. Number one being that we are still criminalized. By the time ACT UP was organizing in the gay community, although at certain points gay sex was still criminalized, it wasn't actively criminalized the way that we were at the height of the drug war at that time. And boy, were we criminalized. So there's all these different divisions within the addictions world that makes us sort of much more likely to have a GMHC than an ACT UP. It makes people sort of in recovery, sort of very drawn to being much more establishment and less radical. Not to say that there aren't some fabulous radical people in recovery, but what you see is organizations that are sort of filled with people who work in the treatment industry and they advocate for more treatment. And that is not advocating for the patient. They really don't like it when I say that, but the reality is that those are different perspectives and they need different representation. It's not to say that we shouldn't have people who have addiction in the treatment field. It's just that if your livelihood depends on being in a position in the field, you're going to have a slightly different perspective than your patients do. And both perspectives need to be represented. So we need, you know, we have a bunch of quasi GMHC establishment addiction activist organizations, and some of them are doing great work and some of them are doing absolutely horrible stuff to pain patients by doing activism, which is all about we're getting money out of the drug companies, opioids are evil, and we need to not let anybody ever have them again. And this is literally killing people in pain because people sometimes actually do need opioids. And the idea that like cutting them off and saying that no, opioids should never be used for chronic pain. In fact, they shouldn't even be used for acute pain. It's just crazy. And I just see the destruction all around. So I've really tried to, you know, argue that people in pain and people with addiction need to work together and recognize, first of all, what is our currently most effective treatment for opioid addiction? Opioids. Buprenorphine, probably heroin does just as well. Dilaudid also seems to do quite well. So creating a system that makes it harder to get the medications for either pain or addiction is not in the best interest of anybody. Now, we obviously don't want to have people giving out 60 oxycodones when you have a root canal removed, but or tooth removed or whatever. That was the incoherent dental statement. But thankfully, I'm not an expert on dentistry, so I don't have to account for that. But the point is just that we can have the opioid situation always goes from complete liberty to complete abstinence. And we really need a swing of the pendulum that stays in the middle, that says, yes, some people need opioids, whether for chronic pain or for addiction. And we don't need to make their lives miserable with constant drug tests and constant surveillance. Do we need to be careful about giving opioids to opioid naive people? Yes, we do. But if they are just getting opioids in the hospital, that doesn't, you know, we have this crazy idea that like somebody comes in the hospital in extreme pain and we give them an opioid and that turns them into a zombie who immediately knows where to find a drug dealer. That is just not the case. It is not easy actually to go buy opioids on the street. People just think, oh, well, everybody can get it, so they just get it. And like, no, like it's like you will get ripped off. Even experienced drug users get ripped off all the time. It is a reason that it becomes sort of a career to actually find this stuff on the street, and not just because you have to generate the money you need. So, because sometimes you end up needing more money because you get ripped off. So this notion that if we give people adequate pain care with opioids in the hospital, this creates this automatic ongoing addiction. It's just ludicrous. That is not how addiction works. It requires repeated exposure, and it also requires access to a supply.
I couldn't agree more that the all or nothing thinking around pain is one of the most important contemporary, I hesitate to say the word battlefield because I think the martial metaphors are kind of overused and maybe harmful, but one of the most important like future directions or things that needs to be healed. We don't have too much time left together. So I'm wondering if you have any other guidance, anything else, like lessons from the history of harm reduction that tell you about what we have to do next, what are our most pressing issues, and maybe even the unexpected lessons you got about from the history about where we go next and what we need to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that was clear from ACT UP's history and AIDS activism is that it is important to have a division between the people who are service providers, like Gay Men's Health Crisis, and the people who are yelling in the street, like ACT UP. You need both. Somebody's temperament may be more like, I'm an established person, I don't want to like go shouting in the street. Or you may be like, I'm a rebel, you know, like I need to like get out there and like, you know, demonstrate and all of this. It's great that we have people with many different temperaments, and there's roles for everybody in making this better, some within the system and some from without. So I think that was very clear in the history. I also think that it is very difficult to organize active drug users. And the one surprising thing that I found that does seem to help is actually just paying them to show up, and not large amounts of money either. Like in Vancouver, where they have a very active drug user organization. In fact, they have multiply active drug user organizations who are currently fighting for and not completely winning. They have on paper access to safe supply, and doctors are supposed to be prescribing stimulants and opioids for people so that they don't have to score on the street. That is easier said than done, because there aren't that enough doctors that are actually doing it, and there's other obstacles. But the fact is that like an army of active drug users actually did get a safe injection space, prescribed heroin, prescribed Dilaudid, and now broader safe supply is being worked on. And how did VanDoo continue to be an organization that continues to exist? They pay people $10 to show up at a meeting, and then people end up, you know, first they go for the $10, and then they start to say, wait a minute, you know, we're actually making a difference here. And they get drawn in and become activists, and often dramatically reduce their drug use in the process, because, you know, you need to show up. And so it also, like, I think, oh my God, I'm going to space the guy's name, Dean. He would say that you sort of have less space in your head to be obsessing about the drugs all the time when you're trying to work on the activism. And so if you want to create a strong active users movement in the United States, pay people small amounts of money to show up to meetings and provide a sort of infrastructure like that. I know that sounds very bizarre, but that was also what worked in the Netherlands. Like, the junkie buns and stuff like that had institutional support. And when you're dealing with a population that's so criminalized, that is really critical. So the other thing, of course, is that there is this kind of separation between active drug users and, quotes, people in recovery, although there are active drug users who are definitely in recovery in varying ways. So anyway, we're not going to get in, I don't think we have time to get into any positive change. But the point being that abstinent folks and people who are still using sometimes have difficulty working together. And that can be overcome, but it is another obstacle to an ACT-UP-like organization for people with addiction. So it's like ACT-UP was also lucky in the fact that in New York, there were rich white gay men who had resources and who knew how to, you know, mess with the system. In the drug user community, we have such people, but they don't tend to be activists. Like, I was really, I don't think I put this in the book, but at a certain point, I tried to get rock stars to do a benefit for Needle Exchange. And I thought, well, how many rock stars aren't IV drug users? This should be easy. Now, obviously, I wasn't a concert organizer, so that is another issue. But the fact is that, like, it was real, like, people like Eric Clapton, and who I now know is a notorious jerk, but I didn't know then, they would do benefits for like Hazelden or abstinence rehabs, but they wouldn't do anything, even though they had written songs that promoted IV drug use all over the place. So my career as a concert promoter did not last long, although we did have a benefit for the Lower Side Needle Exchange and had some good people there. And we did get some money from the Grateful Dead. So, you know, but it was just the sort of rich and well-resourced people in the addictions field haven't historically supported harm reduction and the kind of activism that rich gay men supported in the gay community during AIDS. I would love to see this happen now, but it is an extremely difficult community to organize because of these ideological divisions, because of the 12-step versus no, abstinence versus no, recovering versus like continuing to use in a chaotic fashion. But I still think that, you know, I've seen it myself. You know, the group within ACT UP that did Needle Exchange was not huge, but they changed the world. They got Needle Exchange happening in New York. And the fact is that like most of the existing major Needle Exchanges in New York were founded by activists, most of whom were in ACT UP. And we went in New York from having 50% or more of our IV drug users HIV positive to now it's less than 3%. In fact, these little tiny counties in rural America have more AIDS cases in IV drug users than New York City does, because we did Needle Exchange and we got the laws changed so that, you know, you're not getting arrested for needle possession, although there are still some issues related to that, but we got it legal in pharmacies. And you know, so people can do this. It's just, it's difficult. And I think there may also be a sort of thing where, you know, I'm the kind of person who is much better alone with my keyboard than I am, like, otherwise I'd probably be out there on the streets yelling. But, you know, people are difficult and prickly. And this was another reason I was afraid of writing this book.
Well, people are difficult and prickly, but I think, you know, there's plenty of examples of polarization and division. And But I think one of the great remedies for that is going deeply into the human real stories of people who have done the work and what their actual struggles are. And I think you've done a beautiful job with that. And like we've said a couple of times in this conversation, I think there are points of connection and synthesis. Like these walls that divide us are often artificial. And harm reduction doesn't need to be like a term non grata. It can be integrated into what we're doing.
No, and I find it very interesting that right now, you know, Biden administration is like sort of embracing the term, but not totally getting what that means in terms of, no, you can't actually prosecute people for drug-induced homicide and do harm reduction. That is actually producing harm. You know, you can't criminalize drug use and do, you know, so they need some lessons, I think. But I'm hoping that, you know, when you become familiar with the idea and when you see the enormous amount of research supporting it, I mean, you just see the human interaction that occurs in it. It's very hard to continue to oppose it.
Right. Well, that may get back to that tension I brought up at the beginning, where you could look at harm reduction as nothing more than a set of concrete practices, or you could look at it as an attitude and a stance and a philosophy of justice. I think it's easy to pay lip service and do the former, but not necessarily bring in the sort of like spirit and the intention of the latter. And so that's why it's good to think really deeply about what harm reduction means and what's the best way to implement it, I think.
Yeah, and I mean, that was really what I tried to get people to start doing with the book, because I wanted people to know what the key issues are, know what the philosophical things are, and see that played out through people's experiences. And it is like, when you sort of get harm reduction, it is a kind of paradigm shift and a life, you know, altering way of looking at things, because you can basically go through the world and be like, I know I'm going to do harm. Let me try to minimize the harm I'm doing, right? You know, and I mean, like, if you think about the environment or global climate change, you know, the pandemic, there's so many areas in which the concept is really useful. I mean, but one thing I did notice when I was reporting the book was that a lot of people were stuck on the, oh, harm reduction is needle exchange, or harm reduction is naloxone. And they didn't understand the connections. They didn't understand the like broader philosophy part. And, you know, okay, some people, that's just not their cup of tea. But I would hope to get more people thinking about that, because if you can think in this style, and it's very similar actually to thinking about doing things in a genuinely trauma-informed fashion, because like once you have that mindset, it's very clear at least what not to do. It's not necessarily clear what to do, but what not to do is pretty clear.
Yeah, we need those lessons. I mean, just from psychotherapy, the best evidence that we have is the treatment alliance and the human connection, and what Carl Rogers called unconditional positive regard is the thing that's the special sauce. That's the juice. That's the thing that makes it work. And so if you can give people that and then refrain from the harmful stuff, then you've already come a long way.
I think that, you know, Rogers' unconditional positive regard is the essence of harm reduction. Like, you are saying, you are okay. I want you to live. I am not trying to change you. I am just trying to like help you become the best version of you that you want to be. And that is, you can get very spiritual about that. Like, it is very, you know, it's just pure love, and that's, it works.
It does work. Maya, thank you so much for your time. I see that we're already a little over time, but there's so much to talk about here. And who knows, maybe after a few months of the Biden administration and what they do and don't do, there'll be room for another consideration of, you know, what we need and how far we're going and where we're headed. But hopefully your book and all the other efforts will be a step forward and an opportunity to consider how we can use these principles and practices to help all people in their flourishing. So where can people find more about you? Where'd you like to send folks to learn more about you and your book?
Sure. So there's two places that I can generally be found. Maya SZ, MAIA, S like Sam, Z like zebra.com is my website, and that has the info for buying the book and my other books and a lot of my other writing. And then I spend way too much time on Twitter, which is the same handle, at Maya as Z. But I have to say, although there's lots of horrible, nasty stuff on Twitter, drug Twitter, addiction Twitter, and pain Twitter is actually kind of a really nice community. And I've met wonderful people and made amazing connections. And it is really, like, it kind of reminds me of the early days of the internet, where you could find a group of like-minded people from around the world and really create a little community. Now, that isn't to say that everybody's perfect and we don't scream at each other sometimes, but that happens in families too. So I can't, like, you know, but I try to make sure that, because I freelance, like, it's not like there's one place where I'm always writing. So I try to make sure that I tweet all the stuff that I write and announce the stuff that I'm doing.
That's great. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, as a physician and a treatment professional, I can talk to researchers, I can talk to people in the traditional treatment system, but Twitter has been a tremendous boon in terms of learning and interacting with people I never would have encountered otherwise. And it's so crucial, especially for people, like, quote unquote, within the system, to hear the voices of people who are systemically oppressed by our drug policies, or people who have been on the receiving end of some of the harms that you talk about. So I'm with you. Like, Twitter is a dumpster fire in general, but maybe if you follow Maya and you stick to the high quality stuff, then it'll be better.
Also, cats. I do tweet about cats. So if you hate cats, you probably don't want to follow me.
Fair enough. Yeah. Well, who hates cats? Come on. Maya, thanks again for your time. It was really lovely speaking with you. And thanks for this amazing contribution to the literature of addiction and harm reduction.
And thank you so much for having me. And yeah, I will be happy to come back in a few months and see where we're at.
All right. Take care.
That's our episode with Maya. Thanks so much for listening. I really hope it was useful. It really reinforced my respect for the complexity of drug policy and the way that it relates to addiction. I really appreciate how Maya speaks with such passion and clarity, but also nuance. At one level, it's a very straightforward and clear message she's giving us, but then each of her responses could be a real deep dive podcast in itself, like the notion of prescription heroin or the challenges of thinking through coercion, and just generally the challenge of keeping the person at the center of the treatment, rigorously thinking through what's most useful in a clinical context and otherwise. And I think human stories really help with that. And so if you agree, then read her book for more of those stories. And more generally, if you're interested in diving deeper into any of the topics we've discussed, you can head over to my website and read the show notes, sign up for my newsletter. For this episode in particular, I found some really fun information about some of those pioneers in the harm reduction and 12 steps that she mentioned, Richard Elovich and Alan Clear. There's an amazing panel interview between Alan Clear and some other figures, including Larry Kramer going toe-to-toe with Tony Fauci from ages ago, which is really fascinating in light of today's public health debates. And generally, if you enjoyed this, if you think this podcast is useful and you'd like to hear more, I'd really appreciate it if you could help me get the word out. The best way is to leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And even better, just right now, you can think of one other person in your life who might find this useful. Maybe somebody with a personal experience of addiction in their lives, or just has some other connection to it. Just shoot them a message and share the show with them. It might feel like a small thing, but it truly helps in big ways in these early days. So thank you so much for sharing and for being a part of this podcast experiment I'm doing. This podcast is for general informational purposes only. It isn't medical or clinical advice. The content is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. So if you have questions, please consult a medical professional. Conflicts of interest are an important topic in addiction and recovery. For now, the show is 100% editorial independent, and I'm just doing it to share and connect. I'm committed to keeping an updated list of any disclosures necessary on my website.